Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Jeanette Parker, and I am coming to you live from Lawrence, Kansas. And we are very, very privileged today to have some wonderful guests to help me with this very, very important topic we're going to be talking to about today. Just to remind you, this is Dr. Jeanette Parker. I am the Executive Director of Medical Whistleblower located here in Lawrence, Kansas. And we are an advocacy network for persons who are whistleblowers who report medical fraud, patient abuse and neglect, and human rights violations to federal, state, and international authorities. I would like to get our guests online here, and so I'm going to get Dan Haley on the line, I believe. Let's see if we can get him on. Hello, Dan.
Good evening, Jeanette, and thank
you
for inviting me.
Are you there?
How are you?
Okay. Well, I'm really, really happy to have you on my show today. And just for those of you who don't already know Dan Haley is a transportation whistleblower. He is a pilot. And he has, for many, many years, been flying those big planes with our own lives inside them. Right, Dan?
That's correct, Jeanette. And Wayne has sterling credentials that exceed mine. I'm more humble than that. But, yes, I've been flying. I started flying in 1969.
And airline pilots are not federal employees. Pilots, mechanics, and flight dispatchers are federally licensed employees. And pilots must possess a federally issued medical certificate issued by an FAA medical examiner. Is that not true?
That is correct.
Now, what kind of commercial aircraft did you fly?
737, 727, a couple seats there.
And how many human lives are held in one of those planes?
Well, the bigger the airplane, the more lives you have. You get up to the 777, Boeing 777, which was the last airplane I flew for several years. You've got about 250 folks back there counting on your judgment to do the right thing,
right,
including reporting safety issues when you see them. So.
Now, you worked for United Airlines, was it?
That's correct. I was hired by them in 1978. So I actually was removed from schedule in 2003, so I had about 25 years, more or less.
And that was tens of thousands of air miles, wasn't it?
Well, my total cumulative experience is about 20,000 hours, but I had 10 years flying the P-3 Orion aircraft in the Navy chasing submarines, so... yes, it's quite a bit of experience, not as much as some other pilots out there, but it is quite a bit.
Well, it's pretty impressive to me, I can say. My only experience in flying a plane was taking some flight lessons in a little Piper, and one time doing one of those planes that don't really have an engine, just a glider, where they drag you up with another plane and let you go.
Well, that's another story altogether. I think that maybe Sully Sullenberger and Jeff Skiles might be able to talk to you about that. I've never flown gliders.
Oh, well. Anyway, I found it a lot of fun to fly a plane. But I wouldn't want to be doing it with other people's lives and the balance and the way you had to do so. And you also have some military experience, do you not?
Right. That's what I was just mentioning, the P-3 aircraft. That is a Navy patrol airplane that has about 10 different missions, the primary one being chasing submarines. And we did a pretty good job there because we put the Soviet fleet out of business, submarine fleet out of business. So, but that I stopped flying those back in 85 or 84. I mean.
Now, being an airplane pilot, sitting in the left seat, as you put it, and being in charge. You're also a leader of a team effort to take care of the passengers, to get the plane safely off and the runway and safely landed again. Is that not so?
That's correct. The team doesn't start at the nose and end at the cockpit door. The flight attendants are an integral part of the whole team back there, and we all work together. And a lot of people don't actually see what goes on in that regard. There's actually a program called Command Leadership Resource Management, and it involves engaging everybody on the team, including outside resources such as dispatchers, weathermen. So it is a big team, and it's more than what the traveling public actually sees when they sit back there and enjoy their meal. Anyhow.
And when you're in charge of that kind of a situation, and certainly the pilot is the most critical person for the safety of everyone involved, you have to make a lot of decisions very rapidly, and sometimes under stress. And many of those things the passengers don't even know you're making choices about. I mean, something could go wrong with the engine. Something could happen in terms of weather. Any number of incidences could happen that would require a pilot to make sudden choices. Isn't that true?
I'm so glad you brought that up because, yes, the traveling public, the public at large, mainly have a gross misperception on what goes on up there. They think pilots sit up and drink coffee, push buttons, and that automation is what's flying the airplane. And they can't get inside the pilot's head because it's a multidimensional, dynamic, complex environment, and they don't listen to what's happening up there. So there really is a lot more to the job than what meets the eye. And it does count how many times a pilot walks down a jetway as far as his ability to cope with all the, I don't even want to call them stressors, it's just part of the job.
Well, it can be a kind of stress. It depends on what's happening. I myself had two incidents that happened to me when I was flying, and I have flown many hours with someone else in the pilot seat. One of them was when I was dispatched to Peru as a Peace Corps volunteer, and we went to Florida for our base training, and then we were flown from Florida to Colombia, and then from Colombia to Peru. And when we landed in Colombia, they realized that Peru was in the middle of an earthquake. The Lima airport was being shaken pretty well with a very, very large 7.5 earthquake, I think. And so we delayed leaving Colombia initially, had to put in to just sit around and wait around, and we could have to have a lot of fuel to get from Colombia to Peru. And then we took off to go to Lima, to land in Lima, and when we got there, they were being hit with another whole set of quakes and tremors, and I had never realized that earthquakes aren't just one event, you know. Our pilot circled for a very long time coming into the Lima airport, and of course wasting fuel while he's trying to figure out whether he can put the plane down.
Right.
And we didn't have a nearby airport. I mean, it's not like you could fly to Arequipa with the plane we were on. It was a big 747. And there aren't that many airports in that part of the world that take that kind of plane safely.
Been there, yes.
And obviously the whole coast there was involved in the earthquake. So we eventually got to the point where fuel was running out. We had a choice of going to Brazil with the plane, trying to get to Brazil with the plane, or trying to land. And the pilot actually placed that plane down on that runway while the earthquake was happening.
Unbelievable. Yeah, that's the other part of it that passengers don't see, is what, even in a very busy terminal area with a lot of alternate airports around, if there's thunderstorms, we don't have, it costs money to carry fuel. So, companies try to say, don't take more than you need. And you get in a hold situation where everybody is diverting, like a 777 cannot go land at a small airport. It won't accommodate them. So the bigger the airplane, the more complex the problem becomes. That is a challenge when you're in weather in a terminal area and you've got a lot of holding going on and you're not sure how soon you're going to get on the ground. But that just comes with the job, okay? The experienced pilots out there know that's, I mean, they've been doing it that long and they make wise decisions, and those are the things that passengers don't see.
Well, I'd like to get our other guest here on the line if I can, Dan, for a moment. Let me just click him in.
I know this man.
Hello, and
hello,
who have I got here?
It's Wayne.
Hi, Wayne. Well, I didn't have a chance to have you send me your bio, so I'd like you to kind of tell our listeners, and we are live right now, our listeners a little bit about your own experience.
Well, I got one question first. You're not related to Senator Barbara Boxer, are you?
No, I'm not.
Well, okay, then I'll call you ma'am, if I may, because that's a sign of respect.
Starting already, Jeanette.
Anyway, I'm now 71 years old. I've been retired 11 years. I retired in 1998 from Delta Airlines. I spent 12 and a half years on active duty in the U.S. military. I started out in the Marine Corps, went to the Naval Academy, got out, resigned to get married, got out, played professional football for a year, joined the 82nd Airborne after I got separated, OCS, flight school, two tours in Vietnam. I fought in the Idrang Valley with General Hal Moore and back in 65. And then I got out after 12 and a half years and two tours, and then I went with Delta Airlines. And then a friend, when we were flying DC-6s and 7s out of New Orleans, said, hey, the Mississippi Air Guard's looking for pilots. And I said, well, that's Air Force, we're Army. No, we can switch our commissions. So went up and interviewed, and it was funny. This colonel said, Major Witter, have you ever flown the 124 before? I said, yes, sir, 8 times, but I never landed. And he looked at me like I was really a bad pilot. But I said, we used to jump out of them at Fort Bragg, sir. Oh. So anyway, I then transferred my commission to the Air Force, flew with the Mississippi Air Guard, and retired. So that's basically, I have 27,000 hours, more or less, and some, you know, some of the medals you get in Vietnam when you're young and invincible. And but I was raised basically by my parents, and also the Marine Corps finalized that duty, honor. Actually, it starts out with God, Corps, and Country. Mm-hmm. But to say what you think, stand up and be honorable, and it's what I taught my boys and my daughters, and their businesses are doing well because they're honest and they have character, and that's what it's all about.
Well, I'm so pleased to have such wonderful people on my show, especially those who obviously have served their country and served the American public very well as airline pilots. It's very clear to me that when we talk about whistleblowers, transportation whistleblowers, that we are talking to some of the best of the best, and that when a organization decides to silence a whistleblower, someone who came forward because their moral courage demands that they speak forward, when the organization goes after that whistleblower, that they quite frequently go after them with what is called a workplace evaluation. And I have seen this happen in almost every different kind of profession imaginable. I hear some pretty horrible stories from my medical whistleblowers about hostile psychiatric evals, and I also hear the same kind of accounts from FBI whistleblowers, and I hear this also from my transportation whistleblowers. And so today's discussion is going to be a little bit about how a work environment can be made so hostile by a evaluation that a very, very competent, capable airline pilot, one used to handling stress, one who's used to making very quick, important decisions under duress, sometimes under risk of losing his own life and the lives of the passengers that he is responsible for, and, of course, persons on the ground, when a person of that quality is then slandered with a fabricated evaluation in order to silence them as a whistleblower, we as a nation have all lost. And so one of the things that they do these evaluations for is to remove the support for the whistleblower, because whistleblowers become powerful by having the support of their coworkers, the public, other people in management, members of government. And when you slander somebody with something really heinous against their personal character or their professional competence, it is much easier to then win that war before anything ever even gets to the court or investigated by a governmental authority. So I'm going to turn this back to Dan and ask Dan if he's seen this kind of problem of hospital psychiatric evaluations in for airline whistleblowers.
Yes, I have, Jeanette, firsthand, actually, and it was pretty much a nightmare, not just for me, but for my family. As you well know, dealing with whistleblowers, that's usually the first casualty because of the stigma damage done by diagnosis that you know isn't correct. But, you know, you were kind enough to invite me on the show, and I'll give you a brief synopsis, but the story's really not about me, but the failure in the system. And if you give me just a second, I would like to plug our website, if I could, for anybody listening. If you could tune in to www.airline-whistleblowers, that's plural, .org. We have a contact page on that website, and if anyone out there has a situation that they're afraid to come forward with, we guarantee anonymity. Getting back to me, you know as well as I do that when an individual goes through a situation like I did, it sends a chilling signal to all the other workers out there that if you step out of line, we can do this, we have the power to do this. In my instance, we were in the middle of a United Airlines bankruptcy, and it actually started in 2002, and there were others around me, and you know how the whistleblower routine, because we both talk to a lot of them, you know, it requires a deep examination of your conscience, and you start thinking, is it just me? So you ask your coworkers, and they see the problem, but they don't want to step out in front of the tank, and, you know, I really didn't want to either, but it did impact public safety, okay? So initially, I didn't want this in the media, and I didn't want to bring any lawyers into it, so I tried internal correspondence using what they call a captain's report initially. And when I got feedback that the company thought I was a big-mouth whistleblowing troublemaker and to shut up, that wasn't what we were doing pre-9/11. So I had written numerous letters to my union and actually talked to some of my friends and was pre-briefed on what they might try to do to me. Well, I erroneously believed that if I sustained the moral high ground, professionally, ethically, legally, that I could press forward with this because I wasn't doing anything wrong. So I intended, because I was getting stonewalled, to write a letter to Glenn Tilton, who's the CEO of United Airlines. And I was told directly on the phone that if I filed that letter with him, the exact words were, go ahead and send that letter in if you never want to fly another United Airlines airplane again in your life. And I said, you all agree with me. I'm not doing anything wrong here. How far can I expect people to follow me in? And I was told not very far. So the next step in this process is to bring the FAA in with something, well, we call them at United Flight Safety Awareness reports, okay? The terminology being tossed around out there are ASAPs, or Aviation Safety Action Reports, and I thought, okay, well, if I send a letter, they're going to yank me off the line. I was told they'll do it on professional grounds, medical grounds, psychological grounds, or otherwise, but they'd seen him do it many, many times, okay? So I thought, okay, I need FAA protection, but I still didn't want to go to the media. I still didn't want a lawyer. So I filed several of these ASAP reports, and the tragedy there is, this is 2003 time frame now, some of the issues that I was reporting on was crew fatigue and the horrible scheduling that was occurring at United Airlines that involved crew rest problems also. And there were several other issues I addressed, and some of them were security, but I won't discuss that here for obvious reasons. And as soon as I did that, I was pulled off the line and was told that I would not be able to fly. Well, they actually abrogated the anonymity of this whole program in doing this. And I'll cut to the chase because Wayne and I do want to discuss some other issues here. Long story short, we wound up at an impasse. They wouldn't allow me to bring in. They said they tried to arrange meetings but wouldn't allow me to bring in my own attorney. And so they put me on sick list then and let me run out all of my sick list. And the mistake I really made here was when I talked to a certain individual at United Airlines who was my boss, I said, okay, I'm out of options. Where do I go from here? I'm going to go non-pay. This is punitive. And I was told the Employee Assistance Program, the EAP program, was the route to go because it was endorsed by the FAA. All I had to do was cooperate with the program. So I reluctantly did this, and I went up to Chicago, and I met with United's chief flight surgeon there, and he asked me if I'd be willing to go over and have a psychological eval by someone that the company used at a mental health facility, which I agreed to do because I was told all you have to do is cooperate with this process. I'll back up a little bit because about 6 months before this, because I was pre-briefed by my dear friends at United what route they were going to go, I went to the best mental health professionals in the Atlanta area and said, look, I think they're going to try to say I'm crazy here. So they ran every test they could, and I continued to see them till this day just to confirm the soundness of my mental health. So I agreed to go with this knowing that I had a record that would back me up. And if you go to the correspondence page of the website I just gave you, the one at airline-whistleblowers.org, and you scroll down about halfway down the page, rather than go into detail of the three-day ordeal where I was put in a room with a paranoid schizophrenic patient and required to attend group sessions with some people that were very seriously mentally ill and overdosed on Coumadin, where they found me passed out on the floor. You know, I sat out in the hall on the second night there. I couldn't believe this was happening to me, you know. They found me with my blood pressure 60 over 40. Whole side of my face is swollen up. And why did this happen? All I was doing was reporting safety concerns, okay?
Can I get Wayne in here for a moment?
Yeah, please do, Wayne, because and you need to tell your story, and I'd like to talk about Newton.
Yeah, I'd like to get Wayne in, and your story is so, so compelling, Dan, and, you know, I really feel for you. And unfortunately, this is not an unusual occurrence. This kind of abuse is unfortunately very, very common. And if I could back up a little bit here to talk about the fact that these evaluations done for the purposes of discrediting a whistleblower is so very, very common. Referral for psychiatric assessment comes after the whistleblower has persisted in raising that issue of fraud, corruption, or mismanagement. And it is done specifically to prevent an investigation into the real wrongdoing. And because there's a dependence on the workplace for their own livelihood, pilots require a certification from FAA. Is that not true, Dan?
their medical certificate, and if they pull that on you, you can't fly anymore. It's just
right. So basically, they take away your ability to support yourself,
that's
and
correct.
That puts the airline pilot who's trying to blow the whistle on safety issues in a very precarious position and very vulnerable, and therefore many whistleblowers at that point stop blowing the whistle because they want to be able to continue to support their families and to have income. In addition, it's not uncommon for companies to offer whistleblowers bribes or trips or something special in order to undermine their credibility. It is also possible for the employer to encourage people who might perhaps have some kind of hostility or dislike of the whistleblower to speak out in particularly harsh terms, fabricate evidence, and make up or embellish stories about them. And then there is the tendency in the workplace for persons who are working there to resent the whistleblower, because they feel that it destabilizes the security of the workplace. And this was certainly true in a situation where you have a bankruptcy going on, like you did at United Air. Wasn't it a bankruptcy or some kind of financial problem?
Chapter 11, and it was
yes.
The employees. Mm-hmm. They lost their pensions. And
they were probably looking at the whistleblowers, the reason for that, instead of the whistleblowers trying to get to the bottom of why that's happening.
Well, I knew that if I exposed this to the media, because United was threatening Chapter 7 liquidation, if that were to happen, I wouldn't have to worry about anything because I'd have 120,000 employees beating me to death for doing it. So I was walking on eggshells, trying to do a job, not getting the response I needed, and it was a very precarious position to be in. I can guarantee you.
Now, oftentimes, the employer will then act like they're being the nice guy, and they'll offer the whistleblowing employee counseling. But the counseling that is offered by the workplace environment is not sufficiently independent of management. And so really, oftentimes, it's just an additional victimization or re-traumatization. Wayne, what has been your own experience in this situation?
Well, pretty much just like Dan. Myself and some other pilots had been questioning the what was happening with the pension fund. And then we had gone up to Washington, the Department of Labor, and from there we went over to see another Naval Academy grad, John McCain. And the pilot that was with me was a Naval Academy grad, and he sent us over through his FAA guy to the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice Naval Academy grad, it was just amazing. We were running into ring knockers, as we call them, all day long in Washington. But in 2 days, he took a look at what we had and sent us over to the FBI, the RICO and Racketeering Division, and the guy that we talked to was a Naval Academy grad who had just brought down the Bonanno family in Boston and moved back to headquarters FBI. And the long and the short of it was they took one look at what we had seen presented, and they sent it down to the U.S. Attorney General in Atlanta, and within a month it disappeared. Of course, Delta didn't know about...
Can you explain do you want me to explain what RICO is to our listeners?
Well, it's racketeering. When you have a pattern of behavior, that is basically a pattern of behavior, whether mainly wrong pattern of behavior, it usually constitutes RICO. The racketeering, I forget the exact what RICO is exactly, but it's racketeering. But
okay,
anyway.
Can I just jump in here?
Yes, ma'am.
RICO is a legal statute which was originally designed to help bring down the mafia and the mob.
Right.
And it is based on the godfather concept, in that there might be a godfather person or organization that does many, many criminal things under its umbrella, but manages to keep itself from being actually criminally involved to the level at which they could be indicted. And so RICO is about that level of influence on many, many littler crimes that constitute a network that would make it a RICO or racketeering charge.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, go ahead, Wayne.
Well, in a nutshell, I'll give you the Reader's Digest version. Right prior to a four-day trip, my wife and I had had an argument about something she hadn't done. We've been married 26 years, so she... yeah. But the old Marine Corps drill instructor, German in me, came out, and that's the only arguments we've ever had in our lifetime is about what she hasn't done. But she went out of the house. Her first husband committed suicide, and I made a very low, what I consider very low statement. I said, you know, I'll end it for both of us. I'll blow my brains out like your ex-husband, your late husband did. Well, of course, that isn't what you want to tell a lady. And she went down to the neighbor's house. Well, the neighbor is one of these, I guess, do-gooders that realize I have all kinds of weapons in my house, M1s, carbines, you name it, shotgun from Vietnam. But she called the police. The police come, and they, three of them, before I realized that I better just back off, it took three of them to handcuff me. They take me to jail, and, of course, I'm going, oh, boy. Talk about a helpless feeling for somebody who's always been in charge, because an airline captain is in charge. And it's up to you, as you were talking about, getting everybody there safely. But as I used to joke with the passengers, I said, I don't worry about the responsibility of getting you all there safely because I'm the first one on the scene. So I'm going to get me there knowing you're right behind me. And they laugh. but that's the truth. There isn't a pilot up there that doesn't want to come home to his wife and kids at night and whatnot. So that you do everything as best of your ability to fly safely and to take care of your passengers who are the ones that are paying your paycheck. But I ended up, Delta got involved because I called the chief pilot and I said, hey, you know, I got picked up and family spat and all this stuff. And I said, so next thing I know, they discharge me, the judge does, to Delta so that they can evaluate me. Well, they decide that they're going to send me to a play hospital called Anchor Hospital, which was run by the wife of a former Delta employee. And Delta was sending all their mechanics, agents, and I ran into the Northwest captain that was down there that lost his license for, you know, flying drunk. And he said, kept telling me, Wayne, you better tell him the truth. I says, I don't do anything. I don't say anything except the truth. Well, you know, they're gonna do. I says, look, I said, my mama raised ugly kids, but my daddy taught me to tell the truth, stand up and fight for what you believe in. I says, I've done nothing wrong except make the wrong statement. And whatnot. So, again, I get completely tested there. And this Dr. Randy Smith came in one day, a big, he must have been 6'8", walking with a cane. And he says, I've been sent in to evaluate. And I said, let me ask you something, Dr. Smith. Are you a psychiatrist or a psychologist? He says, I'm a psychiatrist. Why? I said, because you're the first sane son of SOB that I've talked to since I've been in here. So we hit it off, and he says, there's nothing wrong with you. I said, duh. So he says, but your size, because I'm 6 foot 280, he said, your size, your demeanor, your voice is, he says, it's sort of threatening to people. And with this, he said, nothing's wrong with him. Well, Delta said, oh, there's got to be something wrong. So they sent me to another hospital.
Ah, this is not unusual.
No.
It is likely that they search around for some.
Oh, the right diagnosis.
One after another, till they get the diagnosis they want to get.
Yes, ma'am.
And so they want to find that whistleblower unfit for duty, which is an easy way to dismiss the whistleblower.
Thank you.
And if they can add on to that a personality disorder that they can consider a pre-existing condition, then that dismissal can take place without any payment for the considerable damage done to the whistleblower. And I would point out that airline pilots, make a fairly good income, don't they?
Yes, ma'am, after
you
years.
So if they had to pay you for your lost pay for 10 years of being an airline pilot, that would be a significant sum, would it not?
Oh, yes, ma'am. But
that's the liability they're trying to get rid of, and they can get rid of that liability by just not firing you but dismissing you for a medical condition they consider to be pre-existing. And the difference between a psychiatric evaluation and being found to have arthritis or a broken bone or something like that is that there isn't physical proof The only thing that's the proof is the statement of the doctor on a piece of paper, written on a piece of paper, and his own personal subjective opinion. And
which can be bought.
Which can be bought, yes, which can
You're
be
right
bought.
On the money, ma'am, because they not only sent me to a second hospital, they couldn't get what they want. I went to a third hospital.
Oh,
I
well, you weren't sick enough.
Oh, no.
They had to make you sicker.
Yeah, I spent 6 weeks in three hospitals here in the Atlanta area, and the last hospital, and I think you'll get a kick out of this, started writing reports that I was uncooperative, I think, because I was taking over the class and diagnosing the patients.
Oh, well, that's a real problem. And
can't imagine that, Wayne, really.
Uncooperative is a reason to give you some kind of diagnosis.
Oh, yeah.
Let us all remember that when you're a whistleblower, one of the most important things you need to do is be able to talk to the media. And a journalist is reluctant to pursue a story if he or she feels they must explain or overcome the label of a psychiatric disorder before they convince the public of the real issue. And so this is a way of not only getting that whistleblower off the force, so he's no longer in the workplace and no longer talking to his coworkers, no longer has access to the workplace documents, no longer has access to his co-workers, they also are able to prevent the person from being listened to by the media and the investigative journalist groups.
Well, it's funny you should bring that out, ma'am, because what happened here is Dr. Randy Smith would not give any diagnosis except there was nothing wrong with me mentally or physically, et cetera, because I'd pass a physical every 6 months, even being a big man, my blood pressure's 118 over 60, my cholesterol's 156. But so Delta canned him. They wouldn't use him anymore.
Oh, well, that's right. The psychiatrist also has his job to play.
You're right.
And
but he says, I've got to do what's right. And I said, well, I thank you, sir.
Well, he lost his job. So he was a whistleblower from, and I have to tell you,
yeah,
that my group is Medical Whistleblower, and
yep,
we have many, many psychiatrists and psychologists in my group. So there are many ethical and good psychiatrists and psychologists.
Oh, yes. I told him later, I shook his hand, Janet, and said, sir. And if
he lost his job because he stood up for you.
I'm calling you, sir, because I respect you and you're an honorable man.
Mm-hmm.
And
hey, Wayne.
That means a lot coming from you.
But
sir, Wayne, would you like to get into discussion? Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me.
There are, unfortunately, people out there that can be bought.
Oh, yeah. So now,
have one person I wanted to talk about. That's Dr. Burry.
I'm coming
Dan,
right
what I was just going to talk about.
Dan, can we talk about Dr. Burry? Now, Dr. Burry is a man who works for the FAA. And
Jeanette, he's the current manager of the Federal Aviation Administration Medical Specialties Division, and he oversees every FAA medical examiner in the country right now. Go ahead, Wayne. Excuse me for interrupting you.
Okay.
Well, Michael
Burry is the manager of the Federal Aviation Administration's Medical Specialties Division.
Yes, ma'am.
That's
and
correct.
So, therefore, he's in charge of medically certifying the fitness of all pilots, traffic controllers in the United States, and perhaps some other employees for the airline.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
And he would possibly be checking people who needed security clearances at airports, right?
Right.
Well, he actually oversees all the flight surgeons out there that are FAA flight surgeons, okay? He's the oversight manager for all of those people. And the buck stops with him if an eval comes to him. He can ultimately say, pull the curtain over the guy's head and say, you're out of here, and eject him out of the seat. Okay, I'm not a fighter pilot, but basically they can. He's the one that can pull a pilot out of the seat right now.
So that basically means the end of your career as a pilot if he
decides
to end it.
It's over. It's over.
It's over.
What is really amazing is after they could not find anything wrong, I don't know how many umpty-ump tests and everything else, they turn around and they say, well, we're going to send you to our specialist, Dr. Michael Burry in Houston. I said, what for? Well, we can't let you back until we get his professional opinion. Well, I'd already heard about him. So I go down, and just like Dan, I cooperate, everything else. But my mama raised ugly kids, not stupid ones. I started recording every meeting I had with chief pilots, with everything. Delta went as far as to place out that I'm getting ahead of myself. But anyway, I go down and see Barry, and he says, oh, you need to take a first-class physical. I said, no, I don't. It's not due for 3 months. Well, I, you know, the company's paying for it. I can do it free. I said, don't need one, Dr. Barry, because I'd already heard about him. So I go through all his tests, all his physical tests, blood tests, x-rays, psychiatric evaluation, and I think the guy that was evaluating me needed a psychiatrist himself. But anyway, I get through all of this, and Barry issues a report that I am fit to fly, but they better keep a close eye on me because he thinks that I'll pop any minute and that I've got some serious bipolar problems.
Oh, well, you know, whistleblowers all have that problem. Okay. I do have someone who wants to come on the line and ask us some questions, so I'm going to take this next caller.
Sure.
Hello. And who do I have on the line here?
Yes, this is Tim. Wayne knows who I am.
Oh, can you give us, do you want to give us your full name or tell us a little about you?
Yes, I'm Tim Tuthill. I'm a Delta pilot, prior to that, Western pilot. And Wayne knows the full story.
That our listeners need to know a little bit. So tell us what you want to talk about.
We were merged in 1987, and a handful of us sued Delta Airlines over the seniority integration, also the Airline Pilots Association. But what they did to the Western pilots is criminal. So a number of us continued to pursue for years. And at one point, I was ordered to see a psychiatric evaluation. I was based in Los Angeles.
Hey, isn't that funny? This is such
welcome
a,
to the crowd.
I'm seeing a pattern here. Are you?
Well, there's a lot more out there that we haven't talked about. But
yes,
excuse
go
me,
ahead.
Janet. Excuse me, Janet.
Was this a valid, wonderful evaluation that seemed to be competent in your estimation, Tim?
Oh, no, I didn't go. Let me finish.
Oh, good for you.
Hey, excuse me, Tim, I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing with you, buddy.
Oh, I know. We beat this drum a little bit, haven't we?
Yes, sir.
Anyway, so, ma'am, I got this letter to go see this gentleman by the name of Gaines up in Sausalito, California. I was living in Santa Barbara at the time, and along with this letter is this packet. It would take probably, in my estimation, 3 weeks to fill out competently. And so I called the chief pilot in Los Angeles, and I said, what is this? Well, we want to evaluate you, and let me tell you where we came from this. I was very adamant about the scheduling that was going on to the point of absolute danger with having West Coast crews flying early morning get-ups out of the East Coast, which I still have all the records here in a file that almost killed a plane load of people going into Atlanta on the second leg of the trip where these guys should have been sound asleep in bed. And so they were going to mess with me with this deal. And I said, hey, why are you doing this? And he said, oh, you don't have to go, on the phone as soon as I confronted him. I said, really? Well, I want a letter to that effect because I have this very official document in my possession requiring me to fill out a questionnaire that's just absolutely foolish. And that's where it stopped right there because I came back at them. They didn't want to mess with me because they knew I was right. They had records, instant records, in a near fatal accident. Remember the 727 to 200 feet off the ground, Wayne?
Yep, I do.
Yeah, and that was a West Coast crew, and they'd been flying that trip, and they were all asleep. And it was a godsend that they got jerked awake by the controllers yelling at them and all that stuff. But anyway, so that's what you do at Delta Airlines. They went after us. I think most of us went out early for one reason or another. The head man is now dead at a very young age, and I don't know the... never could find out the reason for his passing. He was in his late 40s, early 50s, and he was off the property. And he was a very competent individual. So we, to this day, I do not know why Rick passed away. And there has been speculations as far as health is concerned, but nothing verified.
Well, it is very funny how a lot of whistleblowers eventually end up
having an accident
or some other such story.
Right.
What was interesting, my first exposure to schooling down in Atlanta was on the Lockheed 1011 as a co-pilot, and there were two engineers in the class, and one of them sitting behind me said, we were discussing things. They knew who I was coming in there because of my activity and being quite vociferous about it. And the guy behind me says, the Delta keeps a dual record of people. And he told me of one individual who was questioning their set of circumstances. What the subject was escapes me, but doesn't make any difference. He was brought in, and he was told that if he continues his line of behavior, he would be gone because they knew that he had not filled out his application properly, and they went back and found something when he was not even a teenager where he had a brush with the law, which was absolutely silly. It was just really silly. But that's where they'll get you on that initial application.
Well, that's what they're looking for. They're actually digging for something that they can tie back to say it was chronic or say it was long-standing, so that they can then therefore prevent you from drawing on a wrongful dismissal suit in civil court. Now, I don't know whether any of you gentlemen are aware of Dr. Jean Linane, who is a psychiatrist now working in private practice in Sydney, Australia. But she has been working for a very, very long time with these evaluations, and she has written very extensively about how they are used to discredit whistleblowers. And she calls them hired guns.
Right. And can I inject something here? I just happened to catch Sibel Edmonds has a blog spot out right now, and it's 123 Real Change, and she just launched a blog talk radio show called The Boiling Frog, and I was listening to Russell Tice, the NSA whistleblower, and it's happening with federal employees because on her show, he was talking about how the NSA ordered him to their psychiatrist, and in his words, the psychiatrist said he's crazy, and they pulled his security clearance. He doesn't have a job right now. He lost it. So this is the big concern we have right now for with this legislation that was just passed. Pilots aren't federal employees, but you've got people out there who are, and the breakthrough is the jury trial rather than one judge being able to review the evidence. And we're all hopeful.
And having discovery on the evidence.
Exactly.
When they do this under the psychiatric mental health law, they do try to prevent you from getting your psychiatric records and what they've actually put in the records and even what they've shared with others. They pretend that they can't share it with you and that they don't have to present to you. And they go through making one set of documents that they freely show to everyone, then destroy.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, the stench of whatever was in those documents follows you,
though
it wasn't proven.
This is Wayne. I need to bring up four quick points.
Go ahead.
The vice president, after we exposed all of this, Dr. Berry getting rid of people and then saying, for X amount, if you pay my fees, I can make sure this doesn't happen. I went to the FAA in Oklahoma City, and a young lady who saw, we got talking about things that I was a missionary in Eastern Europe. All of a sudden, documents showed up at my house showing that Berry had come out there on his own at Delta's expense three times trying to get my medical pill pulled. The vice president who hired Berry retired early with a $5 million bonus because they turned around after we exposed him and they said, we got to get you out of here. I have video, not interrogations. Boy, I'm still in the military. Video depositions. And because many of my friends that really know me said, boy, they picked on the wrong pilot this time. We spent over $400,000, my wife and I, going through the NTSB, getting my medical reinstated. They said that they're using the medical process to get rid of people for disciplinary reasons, whether real or imagined, should be avoided assiduously. they had a Wall Street Journal editor, reporter come interview my wife and I. We met with her, gave her documents, everything. I'm probably the only Delta pilot that's been on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, and the whole heading was, when is a pilot mentally fit to fly? Well, even my ex-wife said she'd want nobody, which I was very surprised, said she would not want nobody in the cockpit during an emergency with me, and she was a 10, 20-year United flight attendant. But what was really funny at the NTSB hearing, which this judge was no dummy, my whole side of the courtroom was packed with pilots, flight attendants, mechanics, gate agents. And the other side, they had placed a crew, an engineer, which we have the documents showing it, and a co-pilot on my flight for 12 days in Europe. And these guys, the engineer, 2 years with the company, wrote up, and I hear I had 16,000-plus hours in the 727, said I was incompetent, didn't know the airplane, was dangerous, unsafe. And so they have a pilot's meeting, and he's hollering and screaming, and, of course, I'm recording it, and cursing and everything else. When we get to the NTSB hearing, that's the only two plus the Delta attorney that are sitting on the FAA side of the room. So the judge kind of knew that this was kind of ridiculous. Well, after a week of testimony and hearings, they had a doctor come in from L.A., and this is like Tim's talking about. Never saw me, never talked to me. He couldn't have picked me out of the crowd, and testified that I had a severe bipolar and mental disorder. And so my attorney, Mark McDermott, who's one of the best FAA attorneys in Washington, D.C., that cost us quite a few thousand dollars, he said, would you look, we had all three volumes of every one of my medical records, Dr. Parker, from the day I started flying in the Army till this incident. And he said, would you look in volume 2, page 986? What does it say, Captain, what his IQ is? 138. Would you look at page so-and-so? Well, my IQ is 159. And he immediately looked at Mark McDermott and says, well, he said, the only reason his IQ is so high is he's familiar with the test. And the judge looked over at him like, how in the hell do you study for an IQ?
Well, you cheater. I'm only cheating.
Well, they don't really need to actually be telling the truth or be genuine or unbiased when they're doing this hired gun in the medical specialties. And
guess who the Wall Street Journal?
Soft science. You know, there's no hard evidence like x-rays or tissue examination.
Nope.
It's more open to opinions, no matter how outrageous. And it's unfortunate for our victims who are whistleblowers on two different fronts. First, the psychiatric diagnosis carries a severe stigma in our society and makes it hard for the whistleblower to get another job, not even as an airline pilot, but as something
else. Well, they even went and had other companies who wanted to hire me, like over in Dubai and all this stuff. They made sure they didn't hire me. But guess where the Wall Street Journal reporter ended up? In the Delta Public Relations Department. They also said one other quick thing. They said, and we got this on tape and a sworn notarized affidavit from a pilot in New York, go ahead and sue. We own all the judges in Atlanta. We even tell them how to write the briefs. Well, that turned on a light, so we started researching it. We found so many of the federal judges in Atlanta that have not one but two frequent flyer accounts. Many were sitting on the bench during trial when mileage was put on their account. They only allowed one. Many trips to the Bahamas, the Bimini, all this stuff. And it was the minute they found out we had these documents, we called the big red book was the pension fraud, the little red book was the judges. They made it illegal for anybody in Delta Res to give out any information on any accounts. When they found out at some hearings that I had recorded the chief pilot and all these people, they put a new regulation in the thing. Remember all this, Tim?
Yes,
They put it in the books that if you record anybody on Delta property, you're fired.
And, hey, Wayne?
Yes, sir.
I don't mean to interrupt you. We've only got 5-6 minutes here, and I don't want to jump to the present, but I told Newton Dixon we'd bring up his case, and if you could just explain about his hearing on Tuesday, who's involved, and your participation.
Okay. I've helped numerous pilots, Dr. Parker, from U.S. Airways, United. Other they call me because they know the records I have, and Newt's seen him. Dan hasn't been up to my house yet. He came down to my house, and I spent a half a day with him. I let him take everything he needed. He was just absolutely flabbergasted at the documents I had and the proof of this stuff. And he's taken Barry to task, and I told him, God love you, you're still, there's still men of integrity out there. Dr. Barry, I don't have any animosity against the man. I feel sorry for him because he's going to have to answer for everything he's done to all these pilots and these people. The man is dishonest. He's deceitful. He's egotistic. He thinks that he walks on water. And I told him point blank to his face, there's only one man walked on water, and I said, we crucified him. So I said, don't think you're equal to him. But this guy would do anything for a dollar. He has no values, no scruples. And during my videotape depositions down in Houston, when his father, who is now deceased, didn't follow the script, he slammed his hand down on the table and just came unglued. And I looked at him and I said, gee, I said, Dr. Barry, do you need a psychiatrist? And then he really went berserk.
Okay, we only got 2 minutes left for you to wrap up here because I need to have a closing.
Can I just say that
we're going to be at News here on Tuesday.
Wayne volunteered to testify before Newton's hearing, which involves a wrongful termination for the same reason.
What city is that happening in?
And down in Houston on Tuesday morning at 9 o'clock. And
we'll
right
be
now,
there.
And in
there
what
are people
courtroom?
In you know, I don't have it right readily
in
available.
In the civil courtroom?
But let me
keep talking, Dan. I'll grab it.
Okay. I'll wrap it up real quick. The DOT and FAA are filed a motion trying to prevent Wayne from testifying on his behalf.
Okay, here it is. The U.S. Tax Court, 516 Rusk Street, R-U-S-K, Houston, August 4th at 9 o'clock, and we welcome anybody there to support Newt.
And thank
you
so much.
Well, gentlemen, I really appreciate you coming on my show here. I do want to wrap up. And it is very clear that we haven't even begun to touch the surface of this very, very important topic.
Janet, thank you for having us, and thank you for covering it, because there still are men of integrity and honesty out here. Not many, but there are still some.
Yes.
Well,
thank
I'm happy
Janet.
To know that there are
this.
Such very nice, wonderful pilots, competent and capable, that have flown those airplanes all that I rode in all those years. And I want our listeners to understand that this subject isn't just about airline pilots.
Amen.
It's about any whistleblower in any profession, whether you are a medical doctor, you're a certified public accountant, a lawyer, an airline pilot. If you are in the military, they're especially brutal to the military. If you're a police officer trying to blow the whistle, it doesn't matter what your profession is. These tactics of hostile psychiatric evaluations or fitness for duty evaluations are used to silence the whistleblower and to stop an investigation into
Janet,
the corruption
excuse
and fraud.
Me, one other thing real quick for all, you and everybody listening. General Schwarzkopf came down and spoke to the cadets at the Marine Military Academy where I was on the Board of Trustees for years, and he said, gentlemen, everybody knows the right thing to do. The hard part is doing it. So do what is right, because you've got to answer for what you do to your fellow man sometime in your life, whether you're a believer or not. Thank you, ma'am.
Bless you. Thank you all.
And all of you, I wanted to give you a little talk about medical whistleblower. We have only 1 minute remaining. Medical whistleblower is an advocacy group for those in the medical profession or who have information about the medical community who report medical fraud, patient abuse and neglect, and human rights violations. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Wayne. Thank you, Janet.
And please join us again on a Monday morning, 9 a.m. Central Time, to listen to Dr. John Verapin. Dr. John Verapin is a pharmacological expert who used to be the head of Eli Lilly in Sweden. He is joining us live from Germany. So please join us then. Thank you.
After tone, record message.